Mr. Macmillan, reel 12.
Mentioned Captain Onslow, and you say he was a nice fellow. In what ways? What kind of a commander was he?
Well, he had come from the Admiralty. He had been at the Admiralty for some time. But previous to that, all his time had been served in destroyers. And you have a few little doubts when they show. But after a few weeks, we realised that we had a good commander. He turned out a damn good commander in the end. It was rather funny. When we came into harbour, when you went to oil, 9 times out of 10, he would give the oil a good bump. And yet at sea, you could go alongside the ship and never even scratch out of it. That's the kind of man he was. I think the crew of the Ashanti had great faith in him. Our first lieutenant was Lieutenant Bailey, who eventually took over one of the P boats. Could have been the Panther. He was a good first lieutenant. The gunner control officer was Lieutenant Lewin, who originally became Admiral Fleet Lord Lewin, who just passed away a year or two ago. Engineer officer was Scott Simon, lieutenant, brilliant engineer. Really brilliant. How the hell they kept the Ashanti going, no one today, this day ever knows, because she was a bitch from the mechanical point of view. Oh, terrible. But anyway, he kept her going. And then we had a sub-lieutenant and a midshipman and the gunner T, who, as I told you before, you couldn't bamboozle, because they come from the ranks and they knew you were telling a yarn or not, you know. So that was the officers.
Were they good in total? Were they all good officers?
They were all good officers, uh-huh. I think you find that destroyer officers are good because they're in a confined space. They mix regularly with the men. And I think they'll actually get to know men by their name, not the kind of big ship that might carry 1,000 men. You probably never see your officer for weeks on end. Yes, they were all very good officers, I must admit that.
Were they regulars or conscripts? Or?
All regulars except one, the navigation officer. He comes from the Merchant Navy. And as you know, all Merchant Navy navigating officers are damn good. Really good. Bill Burgess. So he was the only RNR officer who was on board. All the other were regular.
How did you find your own group that you were in control of, signalers? Were they a good set, good group of men?
Well, I had been with some of them already for 2 years on the Mashona, like with the rest of the crew. It's rather funny to say, but at times you felt as if you were on the Mashona, because the whole layout was completely the same, because they were all built to the same standard and length, etc. Other than the few alterations we used to get rather tickled pink with the radar going round instead of being stationary, and coders on board and things like that. But basically, the whole crew got on very well.
It was a very experienced crew.
Very experienced, uh-huh, yes. The normal 3 weeks working at Scapa Flow to bring a destroyer up, we done in a week. Because the only alteration on board was the new Orlikan guns and the new twin 4-inch with the high. Other than that, everything was just, you know, you could have blindfolded and you knew where the shells were. Not the signalmen, I'm talking about steamen now. The flag lockers and the yard arms and the masts were exactly the same, right to an inch. So you had nothing to learn there. The signal distributing office was exactly the same. in the signal booth, in the SDO, as we call it, they had what is known as the plotting table. And it's worked on a gyro from your main gyro on your ship. And there's a little penetration of light comes up. Now, on the bridge, there's two little holes, like binoculars, where the captain can look down and watch it. And as your ship turns, so the little light turns, tells you exactly where you're going. And they put a map on it, and it more or less tells you where you are. It's more modern now with these satellites, but that was the basic. Everything on the bridge was exactly the same. Eventually, whether through just trying to help, the yeoman signals become on the bridge. Action stations, he pressed the buzzer. Make smoke, he pressed the buzzer. Now in darkness, they're side by side, but you knew which one to get. Or dash over to pick the phone up and tell the boiler room to connect the other boiler up. Or be prepared, we're going to drop depth charges so the stokers wouldn't think they'd been hit. These little things, it relieved, I suppose it relieved the officer of the watch. And then on the bridge you have a round thing which has got a set of four lights on the top, four colours, and four colours in the bottom. I think they're changed every 4 hours, to the best of my belief. You take, you're not only officers allowed to do this. They take them out and they put the new ones in. They go into the chart room and they alter it. Now the top one is what is known as a challenge light. And when you if you press the button to challenge anyone, the appropriate lights light up on your mast. Now if it's a friend, she should flash back on her lights the reply on the bottom. Or the other way around, whichever it may be. The officer's only done that. I've never seen them used, actually, because the chances of meeting an enemy ship were very, very remote. So you knew in nine times out of ten it was one of your own. So I think eventually we covered them up. We didn't use the damn thing. And then with what is known as fighting lights, where you press another buzzer and your white lights appear. And all that really was if there was a bit of a shambles, if you press your fighting lights, the flotilla could get into sort of regular routine, you know, getting proper order. I only used them once. So they were obsolete.
So what happened to you then? You've got on the shanty and gone to Scapa Flow. Where did you go after that?
Well, as I say, we'd done that raid.
The Lofoten Islands, which you've mentioned.
We went over there to do an airstrike against Bodo, as well as a raid in the Lofoten Islands. We captured some documents and code books from the German trawler Gear, which was scuttled at the approach of German aircraft. After that, it was just normal escort duties, and then down to escorting the Home Fleet, etc., covering. That's when we started covering the Russian convoys. We were probably 400 miles away with the fleet. We were actually as an escort then. And then there was down to Immingham.
Are we at the Russian convoy stage now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Russian convoys. You would know, of course, that the convoys were going to Russia then, and they didn't have a particularly good reputation from the point of view of safety and things, did they?
They didn't, but the first few convoys were unmolested. Because if you read in the history books, the Germans didn't realise the first convoy was only one naval ship, the Adventure, taking mines. Then after that, there was one or two. The big convoys didn't start until April 42.
And was that when you got involved?
No.
You'd been involved before that?
We had been involved covering force with the fleet of the cruisers.
Can you explain to me then the convoy system, if that's the right word? You've got the convoy with its escorts, you've got this covering force. what exactly was the relationship?
You have the convoy of merchant ships who would probably maybe set out from Greenock, Iceland, the States. Now, when we come to take over PQ-16, that was the code name, PQ.
Is this the first convoy?
No, this was the 16th one. But they've been going on when we had been doing other jobs. When we took over the escort of convoy PQ-16, we were detailed the senior officer. And believe me, a commander, he was the senior officer. And we had 35 merchant ships to look after that. Well, I think we had about four destroyers, couple of corvettes and two or three trawlers. That was the escort. Now, laying off maybe 100 miles, you'd have a couple of cruisers with a few more destroyers. Then, maybe 300 or 400 miles, you'd have the whole fleet with the battleships and the aircraft carriers, in case, those days, in case the Tirpitz come out. And they would try and cut her off from getting back into Norwegian waters again. So looking after 35 ships, and this was April and May, and you have 24 hours daylight. And the Germans only to fly 250 miles from the north of Norway to attack you. With no aircraft carriers with us, we're to rely solely on our own defence. And when I talk about defence with the merchant navy, they weren't as gunners, not as good as Royal Navy gunners. Sometimes we were thought we were in more danger than the German aircraft they were firing at. I mean, we had one or two shells landed near us. But never mind, that was the merchant navy. I mean, we come in the end to realise what a hell of a hard job they had. So we took the convoy.
So the convoy's going along, and you've got this escort. Where would the escort be positioned?
It would be positioned like a screen around the battleship. We would be out in front as the commander, and then like a V-shape round it. But you kept on saying, we'll say for HMS Gallant. She was Polish manned. She got a bit of a hiding, actually. Go and tell so-and-so number to make less smoke. Because you can, some of them were coal burners, you know. And smoke in the Royal Navy is a crime. A crime. If you make the least little puff of smoke and the Admiral sees it, oh, you've had it. And then so-and-so trawler, go and investigate, maybe a U-boat was seen. Something like that. And then you'll go alongside the commodore of the convoy. He'll be maybe an old First World War captain from the Royal Navy. He was the commodore. He was in charge of the merchant ships. And you would say, now, tonight I think we'll alter here or alter there. It was left to the senior officer, the escort. The first time we were ever attacked, convoy, alter course to port. And he took us into a rainstorm, Onslow, which helped us a lot, you know. And then, of course, you couldn't always depend on that. But when you've got 24 hours of daylight, they could attack you any time. And that lasted approximately there and back 3 weeks.
What about the speed of the convoy? What was the average speed of a convoy?
6 knots.
And you had to keep the same speed.
Well, we could go a little, because we kept swinging around and investigating, but it was dreadfully slow. I mean, you've no idea, 6 knots to a destroyer is like us walking up the street. It's very, very slow. It's a very hard speed to keep to, because you're not built to operate at a speed like that. We used to fire a few shells, and of course, you couldn't fire all the time because you didn't carry the ammunition. It was one mounting when they were so far away, two mountings when they got a bit closer, and when they really got close, everything.
This is the aircraft, an aircraft attack.
Firing at the aircraft. We didn't have much trouble other than submarines. I think the Admiralty had a good idea if the German ships were coming out. And if they had come out, we wouldn't have stand up very easily, you know. I mean, they had cruisers and the turpets were 15 or 16 inch guns, you know, probably we never seen her.
Did you do a zigzag course, or was it straight ahead?
Oh no, you couldn't go straight ahead, because you go straight ahead, you're an ideal target for a U-boat.
So you're zigzagging all the time?
With the fleet, you carry out a proper zigzag, you know. But with the convoy, you zigzag independently. Each captain to his own thoughts, you know, maybe alter port to starboard, and then if a U-boat senior, he might think you'll come back to port, but you would alter to starboard again. There was no set pattern when you were escorting a convoy. There was with the big ships, but not with the...
Didn't that increase the danger of collisions between ships when you, in effect, zigzagging according to the individual captain?
No, there have been cases of collisions, but I never experienced or seen one on convoys, I must admit. I mean, you've got to understand, sometime, especially when the dark nights come, when morning come, your merchant ships were all over the ocean, so you had to go and round them all back up again.
Like sheepdogs, huh?
Well, that more or less, yes, uh-huh. If you thought you were going to be attacked, the cruisers used to come a bit closer. But they weren't allowed too close, because they were very, very short of cruisers. Now, the Admiralty didn't matter about a destroyer being sunk, but not a cruiser out there. Above a destroyer, they were wary. But a destroyer, that didn't matter, because they could build one in a couple of years, you know. We found that out eventually as well.
So can we now go back to the experiences in convoy? This one you mentioned, P-16 or PQ-16?
PQ-16.
What are your memories of that particular convoy?
Just the vast amount of ocean that 35 merchant ships take up, and the small amount of escorts. And actually, when we got to Russia, we only lost 7 ships, which then was a record. It was the biggest convoy ever to sail, 35 ships. Eventually, long after I had left going to sea, when I was in combine offing, there was more neighbour ships than what there was actually merchant ships in the convoy. So, we were quite proud. The funny part, when we come home, as you take one out, you bring one back. We took PQ-16 over, and we would bring PQ-15 back, because it would be empty, ready to come back. We'd join off at Murmansk or Archangel in the White Sea or something like that. And as you drop one, you're oiled. You only once went into a Russian, we didn't like it, so we prepared to oil off the oilers at sea. And then we'd bring the empty one back, which was worse, because merchant ships starting to keep a course empty, it must have been very terrible on the helmsman. Then we brought them back.
You said that you only went once into a Russian port.
Yes.
And you didn't like it. What caused that?
Suspicion. They wouldn't let us tie up at the jetty. And when we eventually seen the jetty, we were quite grateful, because it was an old rickety thing. I don't think it would have stood the weight of a destroyer. So we anchored out, I think, where we're all this way, in Vienga Bay.
Is this Murmansk?
That's just next to Murmansk.
Murmansk.
Just next to Murmansk. We only once went to Archangel. Vienga Bay, and we oiled there.
You didn't go ashore, did you?
No. No fear. No. I think we tied up once at the jetty for some unknown reason. I don't know what it was. But we found that it was women doing all the work. And they were really... A bar of chocolate would have got you anything, or a packet of cigarettes. They were really, I wouldn't say starving, but they were badly clothed. And the women seemed to do all the bulk of the work. Because the men were probably away fighting, you know. That was the only time, I think, we only tied up for a couple of hours. It could have been for the captain, Onslow, a senior officer, to go ashore and confer with the senior British naval officer, North Russia, if there was any orders. Then we'd come out and pick the empty convoy up and bring her back. There was in Archangel and Murmansk a local escort, They used to bring them out the harbour, and we would be the seagoing escort. We would pick them up at sea.
And were there Russian ships that were the local escort?
No. Now, for all the propaganda you get in papers and what you have heard about the help the Russians give the Royal Navy, it is all lies. I never seen a Russian ship ever come out to help us. There have been another convoy. I never seen one. And the aircraft, which you didn't need your radar, because you could hear them, they were Yak fighters, I think they called them those days. You could hear them miles away with the very nose of their engines. And it seemed to be, they used to come, and as soon as the Germans come out to bomb, the Russians used to clear off. So all that propaganda, it was propaganda. So we never relied on the... They lost quite a few ships in the, up there. A couple of destroyers turned over, their own.
Russian ones.
Russian ones. We only lost one of the whole of the war up there, turning over. And I think that was the Simba or the Sumba. And she was going to Russia. She was an ex-whaler or something. She was not. But the Russians, to my knowledge, never gave us... it's rather funny that the planes that were coming to attack the convoys, I would think that the aerodrome would be about 50 to 60 miles from Murmansk. And yet the Russian bombers wouldn't go and bomb it, which would have saved us a hell of a lot of trouble. Why? Don't know until this day. That was the help we were getting.
You lost seven ships. What were they lost to, aircraft or submarines or a boat?
There was four submarines operating round the convoy that we know of. And actually, yes, there was four. We're four about that. And since then, I have found out through reading books that there was actually two torpedoes fired at the Ashanti. Missed. Luckily, we're here today. I think we lost two to submarines and the rest to bombers. But the worst ones were the HE-115s. I think that's what they were. They were torpedo bombers, and they used to skim the water. And they were buggers to hit because you couldn't depress your guns enough. And by God, they were brave. Really, really brave. And I think the torpedoes two, and I think bombers, etc., five. But 7 out of 35 wasn't a bad average.
When a submarine does hit a ship, what's the normal reaction to it? I mean, obviously, it is the ship missing, but I'm thinking in terms of the escort. What do? You try
and find which side this come from, try and pick her up on you. But you see, the Germans got so good in the end that they used to come up in the middle of the convoys. Well, you didn't know where the hell they were. And I mean, believe me, I've seen one, I think, what was it, Mary looking back, some name American, and she was carrying ammunition. Well, could you imagine what it was like? Just one sheet of flame and she was gone. That's what could happen. Others had oil, others had tanks, guns. I don't think the Russians ever appreciated what we'd done for them on that run.
The weather in April and May, you say it was 24-hour daylight then. What was the weather like and the sea conditions?
It was like everything else, changeable. Very changeable. I mean, to a destroyer it was nothing, or a cruiser, but to the merchant ships, I mean, 6,000 or 7,000 ton heavily laden. It must have been terrible for the helmsman to keep on a relative decent course, because the wind and the waves could throw a merchant ship all over the place. And probably most of them only had one screw, where destroyers have got two, which made manoeuvring much easier. Oh, I take my hat off to the merchant navy men. We had one or two merchant navy ships which carried a hurricane. And it used to be based on the bows on a catapult. And they used to shoot it off. But the pilot had no means of landing again. He had to ditch near a destroyer to be picked up. We lost quite a few of them. They broke up some of the German attacks, but not a lot, because their endurance was very limited. And we probably only carried maybe two ships with each for the Hurricane. And you'd, of course, you had to watch them, because you had to try and pick the poor bugger out of the water.
In an attack by submarine or aircraft on this convoy, you mentioned, what was your particular role while all this was going on?
Signals. Just making signals, receiving signals, lookout, etc., watching for signals from other destroyers, from the commodore of the convoy. Solely signals, nothing else. Nothing else. Occasionally, at the start of a convoy, we might get a Sunderland flying boat. And to make a signal, you'll probably find somewhere, I don't know which book it's in now, about the German used to send a reconnaissance aircraft. They were normally Blommenvosses, big flying boats. And there is an instance quoted, I agree with it, of a captain of a British destroyer asking, would you fly around the other way? You're making us dizzy. And the German replied, certainly, and he went round the other way. That's the kind of war it was, you know. It had its funny parts, you know. All these bombing buses, they just kept outside gun range. And you knew all the time that they were reporting your position every so often. They were a damn menace. Blommenvoss and another firm, I can't remember what they call it.
What hours of duty did you have when you were in this situation, in the middle of all
this? There was no hours of duty in action. You're there all the time until the action stops. Eventually, when we got radar, we could tell when they were maybe 300 miles up and you could prepare. But once the action was over and they flew off, you either went to defence stations or cruising stations. Sometime even during action, I've known that we go down and make cocoa. The things that destroyer sailors get up to, you have no idea. Or go down to the toilets, or the heads as they call them, which was another fascinating. Now, I shall have to explain this in detail. On the port side of a destroyer, you have the washrooms and the toilets, the heads as they call them on board there. Now, the toilets are about a dozen aluminium basins and two showers. I think I've explained this, which you never use the showers. And you might go in and have a wash down at one of these aluminium basins. You just get nice and dry, and the bloke next door decides to throw a bucket of water over himself.
We have this, yes.
Right. Now, the toilets had a trough, which you'd get, and I think we had 8 cubicles. And they had twin doors on them. But we found out that when the guns fired, the doors used to lift off, because they were in those, you know, the hinges you slide on. So in the end, we took all the bloody doors off and got rid of them. I think they threw them over the side, actually, because they were no damn good.